Our scripture reading today comes from 1 Chronicles, the 15th chapter. It is a day of celebration because the Ark of the Lord has been recovered, and it is being brought now back into the city of Jerusalem, a day of festival and rejoicing, although not everyone will join in the joy. Hear these words from verses 25 through 29 of the 15th chapter. David and the elders of Israel and the commanders of thousands went to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from the house of Obed-Edom with rejoicing. And because God helped the Levites who were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, they sacrificed 7 bulls and 7 rams. David was clothed with a robe of fine linen, as were also the Levites who were carrying the ark. And the singers, the leader of the music of the singers, was Chenaanah. And David wore a linen ephod. And all Israel brought up the ark of the covenant of the Lord with shouting, to the sound of the horn, the trumpets, and cymbals, and made loud music on harps and lyres. And as the ark of the covenant of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing, and she despised him in her heart. The Lord always blesses the reading of his holy word. In 47 years of preaching sermons, I have never once preached on Chronicles until now. There's a reason, several reasons for that. I'll get to that in a moment. But the books of Chronicles, they were originally one book, and they were divided a couple hundred years after being written, so that it had to do with the size of the scrolls when it was translated into Greek. The books of Chronicles were written about 400 years before the birth of Jesus. They were some of the latest writings that we have of the Old Testament. Now, reading Chronicles is exactly like reading the phone book. Its chapters mostly consist of names, name after name after name, beginning with Adam and ending with Cyrus the Great of Persia. The material includes extensive genealogies made up of names which mean virtually nothing to us. Names also appear on organizational lists. We find out who was doing what job. We know who the gatekeepers were at several points of Israel's history, who the soldiers were, who the priests were, who the Levites were. Again, name after name after name, meaning virtually nothing to us, assigned to jobs that are now extinct and you can't get those jobs anymore. So that's one reason I haven't preached on Chronicles in all these years. Another reason I haven't preached on Chronicles is because there's virtually nothing new in the book of Chronicles. It is mostly a compilation of things that we read in other books of the Bible. If you've read Samuel and Kings, you've pretty much read Chronicles. If you've, there is material in Chronicles also from the Psalms and some from the prophets. You could say that Chronicles is basically made up of reruns. Only the material in Chronicles was actually written better in its earlier forms when you read Samuel and Kings. Another thing about the material in Chronicles is Chronicles twists the truth. When we read about the kings in Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, we read the unvarnished truth about what those guys were really doing. But whenever they appear in the book of Chronicles, there's a lot of whitewash going on. You get a sense of political spin control here. And it's all about how good they were. The book of Chronicles leaves out things that we need to know. It would be like reading a book on American history that didn't include slavery or the massacre of Native Americans, or Jim Crow, or the gross economic inequalities of the Gilded Age in the 1880s and 90s. What use is it if it leaves out the truth? And Chronicles leaves out huge chunks of the truth. another reason I haven't preached on it all these years. Another thing about Chronicles, it was written in about 400 BC at a time when the exiles had returned from Persia and from Babylon, and they were trying to rebuild their temple. And they had built part of it, but it was slow going because they didn't have enough money. And as you read through Chronicles, it's pretty clear that Chronicles was written about 400 BC as a pitch to get money from people, particularly those who had money. It was also written in order to try to elevate and accentuate the power of the priestly class and the Levites. So at that time, it was something that needed to be done. They needed to raise money for the repair and restoration of the temple, and they needed to try to establish the authority of the priestly class. But all through my ministry in all of these decades, never once have I thought that the main message Christians have needed to hear is that we should pour more money into our buildings or give more privilege to the clergy. And since that's the fundamental message of Chronicles, it just never seemed to me that that's what God wanted people today to hear. Now, maybe there are times where people need to hear that, but it hasn't been any time in my lifetime where that's the point that needs to be made. But I'm preaching on Chronicles because I said I was going to preach through the Bible, and Chronicles is just right there, all 65 chapters of 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And so, as I've been reading on it, I've been looking for some message that God may have for us today. And God does not leave any book totally empty for us, even if there is a great deal of judgment we need to make, discernment we need to make as we read through it. In Chronicles, one of the things that we see is, more so than in Kings or Samuel, we see kings that go from being bad to being good or being good to being bad, and the reason that they change is because of the influence of other people on them. Particularly the influence of prophets and priests, but sometimes the influence of family members. People change. And the book of Chronicles accents that, how people change in the course of their lives, either for the better or for the worse. And Chronicles emphasizes the influence of priests and prophets on the kind of change that goes on in our lives. And sometimes it's the absence of a priest or a prophet that makes life worse for people. So that's one thing that's, I think, of value in the book of Chronicles. Another thing that I find valuable in the book of Chronicles is that it points out how in the life of every people, every group of people, two things are essential: feasting and fighting. Whether we are a family, whether we are a church, whether we are a nation, feasting and fighting are central to who we are. And we see that in the book of Chronicles. All the way through the book of Chronicles, the people are defined by their fights and their feasts. Their feasts can either bring people together in the book of Chronicles, complete with music and all sorts of other celebrations, or their feasts can be exclusive and be part of what divides people. The fighting that goes on in the book of Chronicles, sometimes the fights are against enemies and the fights have to be made or the people won't survive. But as often as not, the fights in the book of Chronicles are fights that people are having with each other. And that's not so good. Sometimes the people are fighting the Philistines or the Egyptians or the Babylonians or the Assyrians. Sometimes they're fighting over which gods they will serve. Anytime you get two or more people together, you get two heads together, you have different ways of thinking and different ways of seeing things. And a struggle follows. And struggles are not necessarily bad. Fighting is not necessarily bad, particularly if it helps us understand each other and work out, wrestle out a better way than any of us could have thought by our own selves. So fighting is not necessarily a negative thing, but it can be. Feasting is not necessarily a positive thing, but it can be. And that's one of the things we notice as we read through the book of Chronicles, all the feasting and all the fighting that's going on. An interesting thing about Chronicles that I had overlooked, I knew it, but I'd overlooked it until I was reading through it this week. Satan makes his first appearance in the Bible in the book of Chronicles. We read nothing about Satan until we get to Chronicles. And there he makes his first of three appearances in the Old Testament. And it's very interesting how Satan appears in Chronicles. He is a government worker, and it is his job to take the census. It is Satan in the book of Chronicles who convinces David to make a count of all the people. Now, how does this help us understand how Satan works, that he's a government worker convincing David to take a census? Well, again, we need to stop and think about when the book of Chronicles was written. It was written not during the time of David, when the kingdom was at its most powerful, and it had the most people, and the biggest armies, and the most prosperity. That wasn't when Chronicles was written. There are stories about David, but the book of Chronicles was written in 400 BC, at a time when Jerusalem was in shambles, at a time when the population was a fraction of what it was before. And so Satan convinces David to take a census, and as we read through those chapters where that occurs, and there are several chapters about it, one of the things that we realize is that David is being tempted by Satan to trust in numbers more than in God. David is being tempted to trust the count more than he trusts what God says to do. That's how Satan works. Satan is the tempter, tempting us to put our trust in the wrong things. Now, numbers are not unimportant. There's a whole book of the Bible named Numbers. And numbers are not important, are not unimportant, particularly if we're trying to figure out how to spend money or to organize people. But we can focus on numbers to the point of destroying our hope and our morale as well. And that was the problem at the time the book of Chronicles was written. They just didn't have the numbers that they used to have. They looked around, and they weren't as powerful as they used to be. There weren't as many of them as there were in the good old days. And the more they counted, the more depressed they became. When Chronicles was written, the people were trying to rebuild their country and start again. They didn't have as much to work with as they did in former days. Numbers can depress you. Numbers can strip you of your joy. Numbers can inhibit your creativity, cause you to take your eyes off the miraculous powers of God. Depressing numbers can sabotage people's commitment and accelerate a downward trend into a deadly spiral. On the other hand, positive numbers can lead to a false sense of security. It's interesting to me that Satan makes his first appearance in Scripture by trying to sway people to make decisions solely on the basis of taking account of something. Satan, just look at the numbers, nothing else. And this leads to me to the most important message that I want to share with you from Chronicles, putting together what I've just said. The most important thing about any community, whether it's a family or a nation or a church, the most important thing about any community is not how many of us there are. The most important thing about any community is the quality of our fighting and the quality of our feasting. That's the difference between a good community and one that's not so good. The quality of our fighting and the quality of our feasting. And this is true whether we're talking about a family or a nation or church. Family life is about fighting the good fight. From the very book of Genesis, we find that in order for Adam to survive, he's going to have to fight the earth in order to squeeze a living out of it. And Eve will have to fight against the pain of bearing and raising children. The fact is, most families have to struggle to make a living, to endure childbirth, to raise children in the right way. Most people have to fight their way through the differences they have in a marriage in order to make the marriage work. It is an aspect of struggling. And if we do it right, if we do the struggling right, that's how we become a good mother or a good father or a good member of a family. Family life means that we have to be involved in the struggle against our own selfishness and our own self-centeredness. A good family means people are fighting the fight against laziness, against impatience, against saying those words that shouldn't be said. A good family sticks together and fights the battles that have to be fought, whether it's the battle of poverty through times of depression or somebody losing a job, whether it is the fight against tragedy or mental illness or physical illness or addiction. Families stick together and they fight the good fight. And a good family is one that knows how to fight together against the right things. Family life, of course, isn't always about the good fight. It's also about the feast. What good family doesn't take time to celebrate birthdays and anniversaries and Christmas and Halloween? Family life is about the feasting. It's about gathering at the Sunday dinner table and the family reunion at a picnic shelter in the summer. Family life is about visits to relatives and getting together around the table. It's about gathering for a wedding banquet or collecting for a funeral dinner. Family life is about just a small lunch or dinner between a couple members of the family to share memories or work out some misunderstanding, grow deeper in their love and their understanding of each other. Family life is a banquet and feasting as a Valentine's meal with a rose on the table, or an old couple having a cup of coffee in the morning on a porch on a summer day. We don't judge a family by how many people are in it. We judge a family by the quality of its fighting and by the quality of its feasting. Our national life is also about fighting and feasting, about fighting the good life, fighting the good fight and celebrating the good festivals. At times, nations have to engage in the fight, particularly when we live in a world where an empire rises up and wants to conquer the rest of the world. Nations have to be involved in the good fight, particularly when somebody is bent on genocide. Nations have to fight the good fight, particularly when there are threats to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Nations not only fight the good fight against foreign powers and threats, but nations have to fight the good fight within the country itself. The fight may be for the right to vote, or for economic justice, or for government reform. A good nation fights the good fight. A good nation also has its feasts and its festivals. Feasts and festivals that have meaning and stay true to their original meaning. And so we think about the meaning of the 4th of July and Memorial Day and Thanksgiving Day and Election Day and Martin Luther King Day and Labor Day and President's Day. And we ask ourselves the question, do we have good and meaningful national festivals and feasts? A good nation is defined by the quality of its fights and the quality of its feasts. And church life is also defined by the quality of our fights and the quality of our feasts. Paul writes to Timothy, 6th chapter, 12th verse, fight the good fight. Most of the fights going on in Chronicles were not good fights because they consisted mostly of people bickering with each other. When a church is a good church, it doesn't allow itself to fall into bickering about things that church people bicker over. The people of God are called not to fight each other in a spirit of pettiness, but to fight injustices, to fight against anything that keeps people away from our fellowship. The people of God are called to fight hunger and disease and injury and prejudice and a consumer mentality of being the church. The church fights the good fight when we fight against demons of anxiety that afflict so many people in their lonely moments. The church fights the good fight when we figure out how to sabotage those attitudes and systems that cause poverty and homelessness. The church fights the good fight whenever we make inroads against biblical illiteracy. The church is fighting the good fight whenever we tell the world about a Jesus who is humane rather than a Jesus who is elitist and holier than thou. The church fights the good fight not when we go at each other about things that really don't matter to the rest of the world, but the church fights the good fight when we take on anger and anxiety and bullying and alienation that affect everybody. It's important for church people to be engaged in the good fight, to fight against anything that keeps us from loving our neighbors and anything that keeps us from loving God with all of our heart, soul, strength, and mind. And just as a good church engages in the good fight, a good church also finds occasions for feast and festival, banquets at the Easter Vigil, Valentine's banquets sponsored by the youth, potluck dinners, funeral dinners, hot breakfasts together on a Sunday morning, Sunday school class parties, mix and match events in people's homes and restaurants, breakfast Bible studies, church picnics at the park, the right kind of feasting where everybody is welcome, everybody is welcome, and everybody is urged to come and sit down and join us at the table. The book of Chronicles, while not exactly giving us the best example of how to fight and how to feast, the book of Chronicles opens up this way of thinking for us and inspires us to do better than they did back then. A couple years ago, I asked this congregation if you would join me in a year of experimentation. And so we had a year of experimentation. And you were pretty good sports about it, even though I know it taxed your patience at times, some of the things that we put out there. This year, I'd like to have a different kind of a year in the next 12 months. Not a year of experimentation, but a year of joy. The kind of joy that comes from fighting the right fights and stepping away from any bickering that we would be tempted to do with each other over things that only matter to us. And fight instead the fight of things that matter to people who live in our community. To fight the good fight against the kind of suffering that's out there that individuals and families and the community has. The kind of joy that comes not only from fighting the good fight, but the kind of joy that comes from having the good feast, the festival, the eating and the sharing together. I'm proposing that we have a year of joy. Joy that comes from the good fighting and the good feasting. It's Mother's Day, so let's have joy until next Mother's Day. We'll decide what to do then. It's probably easier to have 2 years of joy than 2 years of experimentation. The joy of feasting comes when we don't confine our fights and our feasting to ourselves, but when we open up and we fight for others and we invite others to our tables. At that point, we begin to move beyond the way Chronicles describes life, where people mostly bickered among themselves and mostly confined their feasting to themselves. The book of Chronicles pushes us onward to the life of Jesus, who feasted with people at his table that made the righteous squirm, and Jesus, who fought every demon and every battle that came along that was harming somebody else. To follow Jesus is more than anything a joy, because we're fighting the fights with Him and we're joining Him in His feasts and in His meals. A year of joy.